This is a download from the BBC. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radiowales.
Hello, I'm Roy Jenkins. Welcome to All Things Considered, and today we explore some of the issues posed by the triple disaster which has brought devastation to Japan. An earthquake, a tsunami, and an ongoing nuclear catastrophe. What are the moral and religious questions they raise? How will this combination of tragedies affect the way we understand God? And should it change the way we relate to the natural world in which we are set? I'm joined from our Lancaster studio by Dr. Hiroko Kawanami, a social anthropologist who's been watching the unfolding events with the horror of an exile far from home. She's been a university lecturer in Japan, spent several years studying in Myanmar, that's Burma, lived for a period as a Buddhist nun, and is now lecturer in Buddhist studies at the University of Lancaster. Two of our guests have been in touch with major disasters which dominated the headlines for a week or so and have long since disappeared. The Reverend Dr. Leslie Griffiths was once a missionary in Haiti, now shattered by an earthquake early last year. He's not long back from a visit there, and he joins us from London. Also last year, floods in Pakistan affected 20 million people, and with me in Llandaff is Akmal Hanouk, trustee of the Muslim Council of Wales, who's from Lahore. He was a key figure in raising funds for relief. And also here is the Reverend Dr. John Weaver, principal of the South Wales Baptist College, a former geologist who writes and lectures extensively on the relationship between science and the Christian faith. Dr. Kawanami, you're Japanese, you know the country and its people. I mean, how did you respond initially when you saw the devastation that came?
Well, it's really beyond description to see the devastation along the northeast coast. That coastline is quite remote because it's, you know, there are all these remote villages and there isn't a major industry except for fishing or a bit of agriculture. I'm from Tokyo originally, and we urban folks hardly, you know, go there unless you want to see the beautiful landscape. Otherwise, apart from tourism, you don't really have a direct connection with those remote villages. So when I saw the devastation in this relatively poor coastline, I really felt so sad and terrible for all these people who've lost their lives.
Some people have observed that it's a cruel irony that tsunami is itself a Japanese word.
It means these very high waves. Of course, we're used to various kinds of natural occurrences. We have earthquake every day, almost we feel the tremor. We have typhoons in the autumn, and there are all these kind of environmental, you know, sort of events in our lives, which is quite, we take it in our stride. But tsunami is quite rare, actually.
To what extent does religious faith or spirituality provide a resource that the Japanese people are able to draw on at this time?
Well, our indigenous religious belief is called Shinto, which is very similar to animistic nature worship, that people believe that there is a presence, some kind of a spirit presence in every sort of a natural phenomenon, like the waterfall, or it could be a huge rock, or all these deities reside in nature. So before even the introduction of Buddhism and other religious traditions, Shinto has really been the indigenous, you know, belief system, which is still there, as you can see from the way people have responded to this, you know, disaster.
Some people say that Shintoism isn't actually a religion at all. It's simply part of Japanese life, a way of looking at the world.
Yeah, you're right. There isn't a systematic doctrine, or there isn't a kind of an institution until the state, you know, in the late 19th century, created a religious system called State Shinto for its political purpose. But it's originally a very kind of a unorganized, just an indigenous belief system that you live in harmony with nature and you draw the strength from your natural environment. So it is very this worldly, and there is no concept of sin, no concept of guilt. If you do anything bad, you go through a purification ritual. So the ritual is about cleansing your deeds, and then you go back to a clean person again.
To what extent are the Japanese people asking spiritual questions at a time like this? I mean, do they ask the question, why should this happen?
Well, at the moment, I think people are just so busy trying to find whoever has survived and trying to help each other. So maybe they have no time to really question these big, you know, issues. But what I find is some of them have expressed the notion of punishment, that it is some kind of a retribution, and they do feel responsible for it. We don't believe in one God, which is not really in the Japanese tradition, but if you question your own deeds, have I done something to deserve this, rather than thinking about Almighty God. So there may be more questioning to come, but I think as a whole, at the moment, people are just too aghast and busy trying to rebuild their lives.
Because, of course, the governor of Tokyo said that this tsunami and all the rest of it was actually divine punishment egoism of the Japanese people.
Yes.
I mean, how did you respond to that?
Especially, he said it was the material greed of the contemporary Japanese that has caused this punishment. Well, my sister rang immediately. She was so upset when she heard this. And many of her friends also responded, saying they were very critical of this governor, and saying, how can you say something like that when so many people have died?
And he has subsequently apologized for it and said he shouldn't have said it. I know. Now, John Weaver, you know, the classic question. People say, how can an all-powerful, all-loving God allow such things to happen? All this suffering, where does God come into this?
I think one of the problems that we have is that we immediately start to look for somebody to blame, as you've just heard. And I think that's the problem, that faced with suffering, people want to treat it as a problem that they can somehow solve, rather than actually taking the risky step of actually being willing to cope with the uncertainty of facing suffering. And so when you sort of talk about the nature of God, and you talk about God who is all-powerful and all-loving, suffering clearly where the innocent suffer, and there is no one to blame, I mean, that actually becomes a problem. And I think that what we need to do is to look at the model of God that we see, where God chose to share human life. And we see that in the incarnation. We see that in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that's where God knows what it is to be me. He understands what makes me hurt, understands what makes me anxious, and yet accepts me and stands with me and lives with me. So we're actually looking at a God who doesn't cause suffering, in fact, in Christ, becomes a victim of suffering and actually shares the suffering of the world.
But Leslie Griffiths, I mean, that's a fairly classic response, but people might say, well, it's little comfort to me if I'm actually going through hell at this moment.
Well, it was little comfort to me to hear anybody say anything after the Haiti earthquake. I must say I had a few choice words that I addressed at God himself. But I just was speaking to a former pupil of mine, a church leader in Haiti, and he told me how 3 or 4 days after the earthquake he went to preach in the grounds of a church that had fallen down during the earthquake and from which they'd taken some bodies. And he himself was saying, you know, where is God? What on earth am I going to preach about? And he found this large congregation of people there, despite everything. And it was somehow the expectation in their faces that made him aware that he was asking his question intellectually. They were giving their response from somewhere else deep in their being. It is the question of intellectuals, and those who experience the suffering that we are watching somehow come to deal with that suffering in an entirely different way, and that is an extraordinary experience. What's more, this church leader was telling me he had come to realize that, consistent with any idea that God wants us to live our lives to the full and with free will and an attempt really to organize the created order and to harmonize with the created order, is enhanced by having a world the way it is, with the faults in the tectonic systems and the rest of it, the geological things that produce these earthquakes. And consistent with that, We must look at these things not as God's judgment, but as part of the consequences of the way the world is made, and then we must get on with living with the world as it is, and seeing to it that we help each other through things when they go wrong, but trying to prevent things from going wrong. And I think that all of that was just telling me, I've read millions of books, but I'm not as wise as some of the simplest people on God's earth.
Akmal Hanouk, what about a Muslim looking at this sort of situation? I mean, do you see this as, in any sense, as being God bringing punishment on people?
Well, I think from the Islamic point of view, it is both in terms of a warning as well as the delivery of all these happenings and sufferings that people have to go through. So it is basically something which we feel that it is basically for the people who are now have to deal with this, is the people, it's a way of dealing with the catastrophe. And the people who have lost their lives, I mean, first of all, I mean, it is very sad to see what is happening and how the people are suffering. But I don't think so. I mean, if that was the way things were, then, I mean, we have seen people who have been a 70-year-old woman. She survived, a young child who survived. There are still few bodies which after so many days is coming out. So I think it's not as that, okay, these people are being punished for something or they are being... But I think what it is from a religious perspective, from the Islamic point of view, is that these are the people that they are warning to us. I mean, it can happen to anybody. Today it is in Japan, tomorrow, we saw that in Haiti, we saw that in Pakistan. I mean, all these people, so this is a natural phenomena. And I think it has to be understood in the wider context. These sufferings and this life has to end. And there are different ways in the wisdom of the Creator. He has different ways of bringing this life to an end.
But, John Weaver, even if you believe that in some way or other there's a warning here, even if you believe that somehow there is strength and comfort to be derived from the fact that, according to the belief that you're putting forward, God is with people in this and bearing it with them, people must still get very angry. Is it wrong to be angry in this sort of situation?
No, I don't think it's at all wrong to be angry. I think we need to express our emotions to God, because it's only when we express our emotions that God is able to deal with them. And so I think, you know, it's important, and I think that that's the immediate response that most of us have, whether the suffering is a personal suffering because of a terminal illness or whether it's the suffering that is on a much wider scale that affects a whole people group. But I think that the testimony is of God's presence in suffering is to see the way in which people of faith, a variety of faiths, will actually turn to God, actually amongst the debris on the beach, as they did in the Holocaust, where people were saying the Shema of Israel and the Lord's Prayer, even in the midst of the death camps. It's the sense of God being present, much as, you know, as Christians, we might turn to Psalm 23. And say that even in the valley of the deepest darkness, then I'm not, you know, I do not fear because God is present with me.
Dr. Kawanami, is there anything within Shintoism which is going to be actually bringing comfort to people who've lost their homes, lost members of their families, and haven't the faintest idea of what's going to be happening to them tomorrow?
I think Shinto is quite different from the monotheistic religions in a sense that it is not only about this world, but even people, humans, can have that special essence. And probably instead of turning to God, because most don't believe in the single God, I think Japanese people have turned to one another for strength and for support. Mm. And in a way, it is a terrible situation, but in the last maybe two decades, Japan has become a very comfortable and affluent society, very wealthy and so on. But you might know that maybe we have the highest suicide rates in the industrialized world. Maybe about 30,000 people commit suicide each year. And I did sort of worry about Japan, Japanese people having lost some kind of a sense of direction, becoming very complacent and even lost. But in the last few days and so on, watching the scenes of devastation, somehow I see in their expression, it's not that they are lost. Somehow they have started to already rebuild the community. They are helping each other. So I think it's about this kind of people trying to help each other, serving the community, the sense of common good, something that it is coming to unite the people who are suffering.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to All Things Considered on BBC Radio Wales, and we're exploring some of the religious and moral questions raised by the events in Japan. But there is still this question, isn't there, Akmal? How do you reconcile the fact that some people, as you have already indicated, escape the suffering, and others have disproportionate amounts of it? How do you make sense of that?
For people of faith, this is divine wisdom. We are accountable. We have come here in this life. There is this, all this thing has been created for a specific time. We are accountable. And as Dr. Haruko was mentioning earlier on, that it is that arrogance, it is the kind of complacency where we think that we have really got ahead of the divine wisdom and we know better. I think we have all been very humbled at the amount of the waves that came up, and they could have been higher. The amount of knowledge that we can utilize to contain the nuclear radiation, for example. I mean, these are all human limitations. And these are exactly where we feel that, you know, the reconciliation has to be by accepting that we know little and we only have certain knowledge, but we are accountable to the Almighty, to the Creator at the Day of the Judgment.
But Leslie Griffiths, it still isn't fair.
Oh, well, of course it isn't fair. And I mean, the point is that I want to make that an attempt to make intellectual sense of it, which is the pride of people educated as I've been educated, leads them to want to do that and to achieve that, is bound to precede a fall. We don't know in that sort of way. All I know is that when I go with my intellectual questions and my emotional outburst against the Almighty into situations of extreme suffering, and I promise you I've been in dreadful hell holes, what I find when I get there is people in whose faces I see the very antidote to the skepticism that's in me. And somehow it's a Western mindset that comes with these sorts of questions, and it's the suffering who remind you that at the end of the day, if you strip them on the grounds of illogicality of faith, you've stripped them of the last remaining bastion against meaninglessness. And that to me has been a lesson I've learned again and again and again. I've learned faith from people who, by logical reasons, ought not to have any because life has been so bloody hard to them.
John Weaver, you come to this debate as someone who was a geologist, and you have been a theologian for years. Here we have a nuclear crisis precipitated by an earthquake and a tsunami, and the full effects of this are still unfolding. But, I mean, to what extent does this raise absolutely fundamental questions about our relationship with the natural world?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would want to agree with Leslie. I mean, I think what he's saying is absolutely right. And, you know, while you can have an intellectual argument, whether you're talking about geology or theology, at the end of the day, that's not going to help anybody who is actually suffering on the ground. The one thing that one can say about Japan is probably one of the best prepared nations in the world for facing volcanic earthquake and tsunami events such as this, because they live with it daily. This is where two tectonic plates are colliding with each other, one slipping under the other. And, you know, that's the geology, and it's quite, you know, you can explain that in quite a straightforward way. But that's very different from understanding the impact of that geology into individual people's lives when transformed into the effects of a tsunami that we have seen. And I think that it's crass to actually try and come up with a solution. We actually live with a dynamic world that God has created, we may not understand why God has created a world which is dynamic and has plate tectonics and has earthquakes and volcanoes, but nevertheless, what faith does is to trust that the God who has created this has created it for a purpose and has created it in love. And we live with that mystery that God actually shares our living in that world.
So is there any sense in which knowing this or affirming this or believing this should change our attitude toward the world, our relationship with the natural order?
I think we ought to respect the world in which we live. And clearly in Japan, they have come to terms with living in a tectonically active zone. Where it becomes foolish is when we have a choice of where we live and we decide to build our villas on the side of Vesuvius, and we could face another pyroclastic flow like that destroyed Herculaneum and Pompeii. I mean, and then that is our responsibility.
Is there anything within Dr. Kawanami, the Japanese tradition, both either Shintoism or Buddhism, which actually helps us on this matter of the relationship between humankind and nature?
Well, maybe you can draw from Buddhism that people do find purpose in suffering. So, for example, many of the volunteers and people volunteered to go back into the nuclear power plant to try and cool down the system as well as somehow stop the radiation coming out. Many of these volunteers, actually engineers, know that they would probably get cancer and die. But I heard one story about this daughter whose father had been working in that Fukushima plant number one for almost 40 years, and he's about to retire in 6 months' time, but he decided to go back and do something because he knows the system very well. Now, this daughter had never thought that he was an interesting man or a competent man, but he was very quiet and, you know, almost they didn't have a conversation. And the father said, I have to go back because I have to protect my family. And that's why he went back.
So here is a disaster bringing out the best in humanity. We also hear, you know, reports of people in other countries stockpiling iodine tablets, for instance. Mm. What happens, though, when the story moves on? You know, the world's spotlight on Japan, who knows how long it'll stay there. But sure as anything, it's going to move on. Now, it moved on in Haiti, it moved on in Pakistan. How difficult for people to pick up the pieces when, you know, the rest of the world largely seems to have forgotten?
It's a very long and very difficult process, and especially for the families who have actually suffered and they have lost everything.
There are 20 million people affected by this.
And it's not only the physical loss, but the emotional, the psychological loss that they have gone through with parents, children, wives, daughters, husbands. So I think it's something, you see, and this is again which reminds us for all the people who want to share the goodness with each other that you cannot forget humanity. It's not only for the cameras. Long the cameras have gone, but the people are suffering, the children are suffering, it's education, it's roads, it's houses, it's you name it. And it's going to go for generations. And the same thing I can expect in Japan.
And Leslie, now that the attention has moved, long moved from Haiti, what do you find when you get back there?
Well, I was back there just a few weeks ago. And of course, the attention has moved away. Although I have to say that an architect whom I know and indeed introduced to Haiti has just brought about the rebuilding of the central marketplace in downtown Port-au-Prince, and 1,000 traders are once more plying their wares. So there is a sign of hope. But when I got back, I found over 1 million people still living under tents. And I come back to England and I find people saying, what have they done with all that money? We heard about all that money. Where's all that money gone? Corruption, corruption. It's such a Western mindset. They want levels of accountability from places that are struck by earthquakes like this that they can't even, manage through their own parliamentary system. But the point is that we do need to remember how much money it costs to keep 1 million people under canvas alive for a year after an event like this.
A last question for each of you, and I'll start with Dr. Kawanami. And it's this, really. I mean, we've had three disasters in one in Japan. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's actually going to change anything?
It has already started to change the people. You see the younger generation who've never been deprived in the post-war period. They've never had power cuts. They've never had rations. Now they are going through a difficult time. But you see, if you look at the social network, everybody has really started to engage with each other. And you see some kind of a community that is building. And I find that very reassuring at this time of adversity.
John Weaver, do you think anything is going to change, really, after even a thing of this magnitude?
I think that that what struck me was listening to an English teacher from the north of Honshu talking about how the Japanese react and saying how they come together to share the pain and to share the concerns and actually are meeting with each other. And he said it's exactly the same when they celebrate. And it struck me as I listened to him talking that that call to weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. And so I believe that probably the thing that we can do is that we might not understand God, but we can imitate God's love and care. And I think that was seen in what I heard from that teacher.
Akmal.
Well, I look at it from a very wider perspective. It's not only that the Japanese people will be coming out of it, but equally we as all living on this planet, we have to really think about it and not ever forget this catastrophe for the Japanese people as well.
Last word, Leslie.
I sat a few weeks ago in a tent with a woman who was surrounded by all her possessions, almost nothing. She had a baby on her lap that had been born in that tent. I sat down on the edge of her bed and spoke to her in her native language. I asked her what her name was. She was so miserable. And I misheard. I said, Viola, which I thought I'd heard. No, she said, shaking her head. I tried again. Julia. No, I'd still misheard. I asked her to repeat it. She gave it a third time. I cottoned on. Diola. And her face lit up. She was absolutely radiant. She laughed at me for my stupidity at getting it wrong the first two times. She was Diola, and Diola means God is here. And suddenly, God was there. And for me, that's the miracle that I've learned again and again from the poorest people on the face of this earth.
Leslie Griffiths, Hiroko Kawanami, Akmal Hanuk, and John Weaver, many thanks. Don't forget that if you want to hear the programme again or download the free podcast, you can do so at our website at bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales. All things considered, we'll be here at the same time next week. But meanwhile, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.